At this moment, trying to find the translation into a political realm of the remaining religious terms of the previous American story of ecclesiastical liberty and independence. The sovereignty of the churches in this country, he said, is earlier than the sovereignty of the nation. And you cannot understand America if you do not know of its unique position in the history of mankind, that here the church is older than the state. The people here had the power to run their churches before they had the power to run their government. And that's unheard of. And this has left its indelible mark to this day on the American mores and constitution. And you will never understand your own country, and you don't understand your own country, you can be sure of this, because you do not know that behind every political term in this country there lurks a religious term which has been translated. And that nothing, for example, of French philosophy or English political thought or German theorizing or poetry can be translated without ado into this country's vocabulary and language. Just it is, however, done all this time, and through you, this constant pollution of the river of American tradition goes on, because you take it for granted that philosophy in this country is philosophy in France, that state in this country is state in England, and on it goes, all these confusions. But those words over there have never been translated from the Christian language into a secular language, as it has happened here. Now we were paused here. At this moment we have stopped at the term friend. And you have only to think of the Society of Friends to know that this is a religious term, that it is used in opposition to kinsmen. When you today say friend, you do no longer mean your family, although etymologically the word to this day just means nothing but kinsman. The word friend means somebody akin. But it has lost this meaning. It has a religious meaning. And the friends have supplemented the, in the separation of church and state, they have substituted for the prohibition laid on the government to acknowledge the existence of religion or churches in its dealings. As you know, there cannot be any religious book bought by the University of California. No religious denomination can give instruction in the schools. The school bus cannot carry Catholic or Protestant children to denominational schools. You have these problems which say the government doesn't know of the existence of religious bodies. However, in 1870, President Grant asked the Society of Friends to take care of the Indian problem and to take a hand in the Freedmen's Bureau. This was not figuring as a religious group. And ever since, the Friends have, with their Social Service Committee, imposed on the American scene this great halfway house of a religious body that is recognized as a body with whom you can deal without breaking the peace, so to speak, between church and state. And I think this date of 1870 as a step taken by the President of the United States towards the Society of Friends is a very remarkable one, because there are times where the state just either has to become the church itself or has to deal with churches. I mean, this President Eisenhower has chosen the way of acting as the church leader himself when he introduced prayer into cabinet meetings and at this visit in Paris. But that's a very risky step. Eleanor Roosevelt, in a similar way, was, so to speak, the church within the state at a moment when the churches were at an all-time moral low because of their social gospel, of their secularism. There has always, the function of the church has always been to supply in this country, but they change appearances. Never be think that because something is called church, it functions as church, and never think because something is called government, it must function as government. The one thing the devil always does, you see, that he always leaves the labels on the bottles, but always changes the content. And if you once know this, you understand history as a constant striving of invalidating of, or on the other hand, verifying the labels. The functions expressed by these labels are indispensable. And it is one of the joyful jokes of your youth that you think that you can abolish the function of the church or the function of the state, you see. You can have a new system of life, so to speak, a new way of life. Don't believe this. The functions of a father have to be supplied in a family. If the father doesn't do it, then the mother will do it, you see. Because fatherhood is eternal. So it's the same as with daughterhood. Since the daughters today behave like boys or worse than that, so daughterhood is lacking in this country. It's a great quality to be the daughter of a spirited man, the heiress of his spirit. These daughters of today just go to colleges and have no spirit of their father at all. So daughterhood is such a function that goes today begging. It is represented by some good fine boys who simply act as, well, don't laugh, this is very serious. And you don't know if this is not the spiritual duty. All these great functions, you see, of the daughter, the father, the mother, the son, the government, the church, the arts, the education, and so have to be represented. And if they are destroyed by wrong functioning, the same function has to be taken over by somebody who doesn't has an official badge for this, you see. But he steps into the breach and has to do it. Now, in the same sense, in 1870, the Society of Friends was available at a time when a denomination could not be entrusted with a charge. The whole problem of history writing and history reading and your understanding of your own history in this country is not to look for novelty, but to look for this hopping around between dead, shop-worn labels and the real function. A family is a family since Adam and Eve had Abel and Cain. But the function, you see, as I said, of a daughter and a son and a father and a mother, today are very often not at all dealt with in a family. These are four disconnected people who call themselves a family. So the community church or the club or somebody else may have to function in this quality of father or mother to these orphans. And of course, since the parents have no children, but only people who go to schools and nursery schools and so on, for whom they have the blessed providers, then the same occurs. Of course, such a poor man, when he goes up to 50, he has no daughter. Now, how can you live without a daughter? You have to have a daughter, that is the spirit of a daughter, if you want to be happy. No man can live without a daughter. That isn't done by adoption either, I mean by adoption of a physical specimen called then her daughter, your daughter legally. But you must have a relation to the next generation through in the feminine line if you want really to feel that you are rooted and embedded in the future of the human race. And you see this very clearly. How do we in America have coped with this breakup of the daughter Zion? Because in the Bible, the bride, the daughter, is the church. She is called the bride, is she not? And she is called the daughter of Zion. Well, there's a very simple secret today that has to do with friendship. People in this country, fathers who get rich, immigrants who make good, people of the first generation, what do? In order to have spiritual daughters, they endow. Now the word dowry is a daughter that expresses a relation that expresses the relation between father and daughter. And it is the most sacred relation, much more sacred, much more spirited than the relation between son and mother. But this has been overtalked in this country. The I simply vomit when I hear this mother talk in this country, because it is just sentimentality. You have to cut the umbilical cord, and most sons never do, and so their matrimonial marriage suffers, and they have a mistress and a mother all the time. But a man must cleave to the wife of his choosing, and he must leave father and mother. This seems never to be preached in this country. The girls, they run away, yes, but not the men. And this is very remarkable that the Bible just mentions the men as having to give up his mother, not the daughter. In our country, now your civilization, according to your mentality, the thing to be stressed is that the daughter has to, you see, give up father and mother and cleave to the husband of her choosing, of course. Her choosing. But the truth of the matter is much more complicated in the Bible. That the son must, you see, leave father and mother and cleave to the wife of his choosing. That's a very serious business. And it isn't done naturally. It is only done by if he doesn't marry for sex. Otherwise he can't do it. Now, endowment is the form in which we have a similar transformation as we have with the term friendship. The friends are related to each other by a common spirit that is stronger than brotherly love, as I told you from the Proverbs in the Old Testament. And the same is true, the relation of an American, I think, in a natural way, is with his country as his daughter. America has no patriots. America has no, is not a fatherland, as the Germans call it. It is not la patrie, as the French call it. But since the country is always considered younger than the men who endows it and does for them something for it, you see, so he endows it, as you endow your daughter. And so dowry is a word that has lost its meaning in private circumstances, but I think only because all our educational institutions, all our museums, all our foundations are daughters of men. And if you would take this seriously, you would suddenly see that the Americans are a new race because they date their spiritual relations not from the past but from the future. If your country is not your fatherland but your daughterland, your daughter country, in this very moment, obviously, you are dictated to by the future, and you are not ordered by the past. And it is very strange that these relations are not mentioned to you today. The reason, of course, is that we live in the era of simplifications. People really think that the idea of the public solves our riddles. If you think of the public and its government, the people, who always consist of parents and children, of father, mother, daughter and son, disappear as unnecessary. You really think that if you bring the television set into every family, you can govern the people. You can make them, intoxicate them, of course, you can make them into a public. Now I mention this, gentlemen, because we have now to turn to the lack of friendship in the United States. People today in our colleges don't make friends. They only have chummy and they have roommates and they have pals. I had lunch with a student the other day and we talked very frankly, and he said to me, how wonderful that in these 4 years in college I have one opportunity to speak my mind. Because he adjusts all the time and conforms all the time, you see. So the mendacity and the hypocrisy is contemptible on our campuses. It may be worse in the East than it is here, I don't know this. But it is horrifying. My son went to college. He has a beautiful, I think, amiable character, but no friend made in the college. All his friends come from his school, high school days, but not in college. That's not the place to make real friends. Everybody here is everybody's friend, so nobody has a friend. Because friendship is something spiritual, you know, and if you have the lowest common denominator, you only have Jim and Joe. That's not friendship. Everybody tells me in this country that this such and such is his friend. And I find out that they have met once. That's very easy then to have a friend, you see. Of course not. The word friend at this moment is of, and is in practically not an institution on the American scene. But it was in 1800, and the, as I told you at the end of the last meeting, the government of the United States, this fiction of complete democracy, has only been possible because the presidents of the United States had friends. That is, people who, for better or for worse, would stick to them, and on whom they could call without party lines, and without much ado. Franklin D. Roosevelt's presidency was only made possible because he had a large number of friends whom he could ring up and say, now you come and do this. Mr. Eisenhower has no friends, so it's all big business. And every 2 years, they leave him. As you see now with Mr. McElroy, that's the opposite of a friend. That's just a businessman. Now, this big country cannot be run without such an inner group. It has been called here with a derisive term, the kitchen cabinet. But that only means, gentlemen, that if you think of the kitchen as a part of the house, and you think of the cabinet as a part of the house, and you think of the chamber as a part of the house, and you think of the court as a part of the house, you can see that what we call government has first been established in Rome. It's the Curia, as you know, the Roman Curia. That's the biggest court, chamber, cabinet, kitchen cabinet. That is different from what your theory in political science always tries to tell you about the forms of government, parliamentary system. That's all abstraction from Greek philosophy, gentlemen. In reality, look around how we got govern with a group of people on whom we can rely, who are our limbs and our legs, down our legs and our arms, because nobody can wait 24 hours. Somebody has to take the telephone. In your case, of course, you're helping. But otherwise, you see, the whole fiction that you have of government through voting, then no work could be done. And you can't even govern by bureaucracy. Because they go home after their work is done, after the 8-hour day. What you call a bureaucrat is a man who is not, you see, forced by friendship and conviction to stay till 4 o'clock in the morning. And Mr. Hoover, Jr. was a case in point, you see, who whined and broke down, had a nervous jitter, then he suddenly had to act not as a bureaucrat, but as a man. Do you remember? Great scam. In this country was not governed for a moment because Mr. Hoover Jr. was just an official, and he was not identified with the fate of this country. This can happen any minute at this moment. You have to have identification of the governing group. And the Roman Pope was like this because the cardinals formed the Curia of Rome. You see, how do you pronounce it in English? I don't know. Curia? Curia, yes. The princes, the king of England, you see, he does it with his court. You have the chamberlain and the marshal, you see. And so the prince and princess, the emperor of Japan to this day, can just tell to say, prince, you travel now to Russia and bring a message to Mr. Khrushchev, you see. So the prince has to go. And Princess Margaret cannot marry whom they wants to go. It has to be at the disposal of the court. I mean, in England. That is the meaning of a monarchy. You have wrong notions about monarchy. The notion of a monarchy is simply that there is a family whose interests are identified. And if you look at the Roosevelt families, you know that these boys never identified their purposes with their father. Interest. So that's a republic, and the sense of Mr. Roosevelt didn't do him any honor. So a family is in charge, and therefore he has the same situation when Mr. Wilson had his stroke. As you know, Mrs. Wilson did govern practically this country, no questions asked. Heaven knows what she decided. He obviously didn't understand a thing. But she didn't allow anybody to approach his bed. He didn't allow a vicar, I mean the vice president was not allowed to do it, but Mrs. Wilson did. This is an interesting fact which brings out to you the simplicity of human life always. When it comes down to brass tacks, you can write anything into the constitution. The natural situation recurs, I mean. Monarchy is not an invention of the devil, but it is making use of the family unit for running affairs. Now, in a country like this, you cannot do this, of course, because here the ladies don't even change their name if they don't like it when they marry. So, I mean, how can you then trust the woman? Then you get the chambers in the democracies. In France, you get the parliament, the chamber of deputies. It was, until Mr. Gould came, the sovereign of France, you see. And this was taken very seriously. It was really the chamber in which people met. Then you get the cabinet government. But in this country, as you know, when the cabinet was introduced, it became the seed of dissent. I mean, all the members of Mr. Lincoln's cabinet in the Civil War wanted to become presidents themselves, as you know. So how can you go on with such scoundrels? And Mr. Wilson had a cabinet, and he would take the vote, and then he would say at the end, everybody, you see, saying yes or no, and then he would say, carried with one vote against all. You see, this is not a cabinet again, you see, because these members were appointed for political reasons to give representation to regional interests or whatnot, and if you have such a cabinet, you can have it in the constitution 10 times that Mr. Mitchell is an important member of the cabinet. He just isn't. He's, you see, the one worker among 10 millionaires. And so the cabinet doesn't function in this country. So it has always been this way with Alexander Hamilton, that Washington had to have a friend, his alter ego. That was Alexander Hamilton. And then he had in his cabinet a noisemaker that was Jefferson. And he could not rely on Jefferson, because Jefferson hated every bit of the presidency and frustrated him. But you can't be frustrated if you have to go to sleep, and the president must sleep well, the general must sleep well. You have to have members of your family. Now that's a spiritual notion, family. Just as I told you about endowment, where the college which you endow, or the museum which you endow, or the foundation which you endow, the hospital which you endow, is representative of your spiritual future. So in the same sense, the cabinet in this country is not enough to intimate to the president that he can go to sleep and things will be taken care of. So you get all kinds of things, and usually you get friends. Mr. FDR has been such a genius in politics because he had devoted friends. He went even the kitchen cabinet, it wasn't necessary, but he had friends. Harry Hopkins is a case in point. And this president has no friends because he came from West Point, and there you only have chums and pals. You don't make friends in the army. And during the war you would make friends, but he couldn't, being, you see, just the meeting point of all kinds of intrigues between all the other generals. And so the poor man has no friends, so he gets Sherwood Adams. Well, there had to be created a special office assistant to the president, you see. They never had existed before, as far as I know. Isn't that right? Gentlemen, you should know. And that's very interesting. This was a substitute for the friend. And he failed him. Not naturally, because he didn't select him. What now? We ask ourselves quite seriously. That's why I feel that a military dictatorship is bound to come over this country. Because the line of friendship that came down from the 18th century has been exhausted. And with mere pals and mere club women and club men, you cannot run a country. You cannot go to sleep, because you have to mistrust everybody else that he might want to become president too. This is very serious, and it shows you that's what I was driving at, that from the 18th century we still have carried over two important notions. People, and that means two sexes and three ages represented at every one moment at least three ages and at least two peoples represented. This public, that isn't necessary. Now the public is ungovernable. And a member of the public cannot govern because he has no identity with anybody else. These two expressions, gentlemen, I beg you please to never to forget this. These are two biblical expressions. Since David became the friend of Jonathan, although Jonathan was the son of his enemy, and since the chosen people consisted not of a mob as an Indian tribe, but of each of freeholders, of fathers of a household, and wives, and sons and daughters, all to be free men in their own right. Ever since have these two expressions to be carried over into the future and so forth. You cannot dodge these functions. Now, we have to define, however, who is a friend, and in the process you will see the difference from a public in which everybody behaves nicely to his men left and right in the when you see a picture, obviously, you are polite to your neighbor. And you may call this very friendly gesture. And people are very friendly on the highway, and people are very friendly in the stores, and the customer is always right, and that may make you think that the owner of the store is your friend, because he is. How to make you get your money. And that's all. But you are delighted because it's so friendly. But that's lipstick. I suggest that a friend can be only recognized if he survives for better or for worse. That he in this sense is similar to what? Now, as long as I know nowadays, they don't last for better or for worse. I've seen cases where the only reasoning was because times had gotten worse, of course now we have to get a divorce. But they never were married, these people. And the test of a marriage is that you stick through night and day, that is through two opposite situations, and you have no friend if he doesn't stay with you through two opposite situations, once when you are rich and once when you are poor. If he stays through the two emergencies, you have a friend, obviously, before you have him. That's why rich people don't know if they have friends, because as long as they are rich, that's never tested. Everybody wants to be a rich man's friend, but that's not friendship. In economic theory, call this satellites. I mean, you just have to read Timon of Athens by Shakespeare, you see, to know what that is. And, by the way, who has read Timon of Athens? Who has read Timon of Athens? See, this sunny California, you see, such a terrible play doesn't have to be read. Again, if you want to know what America is all about at this moment, read Timon of Athens. America has no friends because all the people only like her as long as she's rich. What does this help you? What does it help a country that other nations behave because America is rich? Do you think that's a basis for survival? Read Timon of Athens and then read what he says about greatness. And once the first senator has the greatest sentence in all of Shakespeare, finds it is found in this play. When the one senator says to the other what it means to be great. And then you can thereby, I think, learn something about friendship. So a friend sticks closer than a brother, but you only know that he sticks closer than a brother if he survives your miserable state, if he goes with you on the scaffold, to the scaffold, and doesn't run away when you are suddenly in an emergency. I am of German descent, as you know by my accent, and I came to this country 25 years ago, and when the Pearl Harbor accident happened, my minister, mind you, the minister of the church to which I belong to this day, he has left, I'm there, sent word to me that since I was of German descent, I would understand that during the war he wouldn't speak to me. Yes. Oh yes, that's quite a church today. I mean, you see, whether it's church or friends or whatever you have to do, the words mean nothing. This man was just a scoundrel like anybody else. Or worse, Kagan wouldn't have said this, because this man thought the immunity, you see, of being a minister even under such conditions would protect him from his own contempt. Because how can such a man look in the shave and look into the mirror? He couldn't. So, now we spoke about this special American power to improvise. And then if you call people by their first name, you brush aside all the insidious memories of less agreeable past situations. You suddenly meet and you forget that yesterday you were fighting this man. And I said to you that I haven't found any, and I don't know of any country in which so much has been achieved by this power of improvisation. That a new group can meet on the spur of the moment and handle things very effectively for a short while. But that's an impediment to friendship. Because the real friend, of course, must see you when you are out of honor, you see, and out of commerce. When people don't talk to you. My friends were two neighbors in the year 1942 who, when this minister had said this, published an article about me in the local paper, you see, to defend me against the insinuations of the mob on Main Street. And I suddenly knew these people with whom I had not very small dealings before, next to none. They were my friends because they came out to see in a very generous manner, just writing up my life story and so rescuing me from this awkward situation. I mean, you live in a town of 1,000 people and there's nothing much otherwise around, and you have to live 4 years in such during such a war. You see, it's very important that somebody should come to your rescue. So I mean to say, these people recognized me in an hour when it wasn't agreeable to recognize me for them, when they stuck their neck out. And this is friendship. And otherwise there is no friendship. And you never know who is your friend before the night is very dark, or before you're sick, or before you lose some point in the public esteem. And without defeat, you don't know. I mean, that John, you see, why is John found under the cross together with the women? Because he was a natural friend of Jesus. The others were called, they had an office, the 11 others. But the Bible is very explicit in saying that they were friends. And this, therefore, he is found under the cross, and he didn't have to become a martyr because he, so to speak, understood and lived by the nature and not by a special appointment. And that's why most people do not understand the Gospel of St. John. But the Gospel of St. John is so remarkable because he is a personal friend, a natural friend, who ends just on a note, this note of friendship, that all the books that could be written about his friend wouldn't suffice, would fill the whole globe, so to speak. The earth wouldn't be big enough to contain them. So he just speaks and he runs, you see, as you know, in competition with Peter to find the grave. And he just behaves like a friend does behave in a natural way. But it's very rare that a friend sees in his friend his greatness. And so the Gospel of St. John is so remarkable because it begins with the most remote notion of the friend and then comes down to earth and leaves us with the feeling that they really were very close. The whole friendship as many other religious features of the 18th century at this moment, gentlemen, will have to be recreated. It has, especially by our educational processes, been reduced to mere chimneys. And to have a pal and to have a roommate is not the same as to have a friend. It's something quite different. To a friend you do not adjust, but into friendship you grow and become yourself. Through friendship we become ourselves. And all the other things are what these psychologists call adjustment, which is very despicable and quite superfluous. It just does harm. If you adjust too long and smile, keep smiling all the time, you finally have to go to a lunatic asylum where you are allowed to weep. I mean, this country is sick with tears that are not wet. If you don't have a strike a balance between tears and laughter, you fall sick. And in this country, in Southern California, since especially, you have only sunshine. I mean, that's not good for the human soul. I'm told they even have to smile when they go to Forest Lawn Cemetery. So friends weep with you. If David hadn't wept for Jonathan, he wouldn't have been his friend. But nobody's allowed to weep today for anybody, not even for himself. So man isn't his own friend today. How could he be anybody else's friend? You never weep about your own decay and degeneration, so probably you won't have a friend either in the outer world. Everybody is nice. To be nice and to be polite is the opposite from friendship. The one thing a friend has a duty to do is to be grateful and to be outspoken and to be critical. This you cannot afford in this modern society. The reason is the multiplication of acquaintances. We call every acquaintance a friend because we have, compared to former days, because of these millions milling around in our streets and on the highway, we have 10,000 acquaintances, you see, compared to 5 friends. Now, we don't want to have any one of these 10,000 acquaintances, so we call them all friends. The terrible result only being that we haven't yet found a clear statement who then are the 5, you see, who are our friends. These also run under this general title of friendship, and they are. This is a serious thing for your children. It isn't necessary enough to send children to kindergarten and to send children to school, because friendship is a battle, a royal. Friends are conquered, and friends are lost, and it breaks your heart. And it is as important to have friends as it is to have a mistress or a sweetheart or fall in love. It's parallel. And man is only complete if he has these 2 accesses. And since we now live in a century of womanhood, I can assure you that the problem of friendship between women is perhaps the greatest problem of the next 100 years. Can women, instead of being jealous, and instead of being indifferent, or instead of being nasty to each other, can they be in the deeper sense friends? This has been, of course, such friendship has existed, but it isn't yet transfigured in literature. And there are no great plays on woman friends as there are on male friendship, you see. And obviously there is still a great need of the transfiguration of friendship when it could only be on the basis of victory over jealousy. And that's unheard of the 9/10 of the American ladies whom I have the privilege to know, take it for granted that they have the right to be jealous. That's called a virtue. And they are spiritually jealous. They are jealous against the influences on their husbands, the spiritual influences. Religion and art are the business of the women in the house, so if the men has religious or literary affiliations, in 9 to 4 cases out of 10, I have seen that the husband has lost his, had to give up his friends and his affiliations because of the power of his wife. And I can assure you that is the observation over the last 25 years of this bereavement of the men in this country by the jealousy of his wife that is incredible. is deprivation. There are exceptions. So there, and the number of people who have been left isolated under the thumb of their woman, not because they were in love with another woman, but because they had spiritual interests to which the wife didn't feel up, so to speak, where he was theirs because she felt she couldn't keep up with this level. Are much more numerous. I had 5,000 students in this country so far, and I would think that 4,000 of them have been deprived of their normal growth through the jealousy of their wives. The spiritual jealousy of their wives. That's a serious business. So the word friend is at this moment unredeemed, and it is not taken seriously, and I assure you, in all the educational process, it is even destroyed, because everything is going to neutralize it. If you have school luncheon with 150 people, that's not inducing to friendship. The school luncheons are the death of all people in this country. They make them, even the children, into a public. And I think it's heartbreaking that from California, from this state, this trend was started 12 years ago, that all the children from all the small district schools had to be centralized and sit down by the hundred. That's just the worst militarism I know, this American school luncheon. That's militarism, because you're put in a uniform of behavior, and uniform is militarism. People are multiform, they are colorful, and children have to sit down at the school luncheon and drink this pasteurized milk and eat carb cheese. Well, they are pasteurized, sterilized. We eat sterilized food, we have sterilized friendships, everything is pasteurized in this country, so nothing can grow. And your children, are the most wonderful people in the world, but they cease to be people. By the age of 12, they are public. Can you now understand why I feel that the change from the religious to the secular has been bought at a price? Because very few people at this moment will admit that public and people is something quite different. What we call secular treats a man regardless of his religious affiliations. The public consists of 1,000 people, as we said, who buy a ticket. And by buying a ticket, they renounce all relationship to the 999 other people in this room. They just go there because the relationship is $3 they pay, you see. And everybody else pays $3. And so the relationship is in this manner. Here is the stage. And here is the public, just individuals. And so you come to this strange idea that the world is populated by individuals. The word individual, as you know, is still bandied around, and it means a man who is not conditioned as a member of a people, and he is not conditioned by friendship. That is, he is neither conditioned on a spiritual nor on a biological basis, you see, as a member. A friend is a member of a group, and a son is a member of a family, you see. But an individual is an atom. We have to have a clear price. Down to 1850, which is the great dividing line in American secular history of the state and of our government, from 1776, these two things, people and friends, practically still stood unshaken. The book by Mr. Frankfurter, which I mentioned to you, The Public and His Government, couldn't have been written in 1850, you see. It would have had to be entirely the public people, you see, and their government, and their government, but today, as I said, you have, instead of friends, the individuals, the number, right? think the expressive game on this sport is bingo. Have you ever seen a society party of bingo, people playing bingo? I once was condemned to attend such a thing in a military establishment on an airfield. I've never seen such a set proof. All numbers, everything is number. There where the colonel was the colonel and his wife and his three children, they were so bored and they had to be so interested. Artificially, the family is interesting as long as these people are not just, you see, people timing each other's style, but going in opposite directions. As soon as you want to equalize them, they all become individuals, you see. And I once had a man from Madison Avenue visiting me, and it may be worth telling the story that he inquired what we were doing and how we were living, and all the answers were unsatisfactory from the standpoint of Madison Avenue, where the big advertising firms, as you know, sit. He finally said, "For heaven's sake, you are statistically unemployed." I took this as a great compliment. You see, look to form a group that is statistically unimportant. And you can only do it with a group that lives together for better or worse. As soon as you want to adjust to society and so, you become statistically important and you are made bored to yourself and to others. Figures are just always boring. Numerals. Numbers. Now, I have to say one thing now. How could a country go in this direction since 1850 of becoming more and more a public, so that today even the family consists of individuals? Everyone goes to work or to school. I know a family, very nice people, three cars, they occasionally meet. And they still have the same bungalow to live in. And that's called a family. The son and the mother and the father, but it's purely accidental. And, we are forced. The boss in American politics since 1850 has become the secret figure without which the public cannot be ruled and entertained. Of course, the famous boss of McKinley was Mal Hanna, but you may take anyone. Everybody in this country is quite well acquainted with the fact that there's always a secret that is not shown to the public, how affairs are run, I mean. Whether you have the Kennedy Trust Fund that now is grooming Mr. Kennedy for president, or whether you have the caucus, the group that prepares, you see, the Kennedy procedures for an election. The fiction that a country could consist of individuals has to be balanced by secrets. And we said last time already that the secret of the Freemasonry was attacked by the anti-Masonic party, but I want to come back to the fact that secrecy, in the first half of the 19th century, lodged in the Freemasonry, and in the sense avowedly in this one group, has now, of course, spread to all the big corporations, to all the parties. We take it for granted that everywhere there is a boss or group or something that runs the show. And we only see the appearances on this side of the stage, but what goes on backstage is, of course, the decisive element.